Let's see. I have a couple announcements that I have notes here for myself, or else I'll remember only one of my four announcements. So, yeah. So the first one is that. So my name is Latham Boyle. That's pronounced Latham. For some reason, no teacher I ever had got that right. It's kind of been a chip on my shoulder for a long time. Yeah, here's my office. I'm in office 330 over there, or my email is lboyle if you want to reach me. You know, just a general note about this introduction. I've never been very good at like making eye contact with people or smiling at them in the hallway. So if I walk by you in the hallway scowling and don't make eye contact with you, don't take that personally. I'm harmless. If you have any question or anything just you'd be interested to discuss, you should ask me. I can't emphasize enough. It probably will go fine. Let's see. Okay, so next. So I try to, for every lecture, have a reasonably good set of lecture notes typed up and posted to the wiki prior to the class. Sometimes I'm fiddling with them right up until the moment of the class, to be honest. So sometimes they'll be posted like the minute before the class. But anyway, so but the notes for lecture one are up there. Actually, lectures one and two are up there. So have a look at those. Those are mostly because I think I'm kind of a crappy lecturer, or also very bad at writing on the board, and I erase the things that I write out of habit before people have a chance to write them down. And I'm going to try not to do that. But anyway, hopefully the lecture notes will mitigate some of that. And then a final introductory announcement is that so I will try to remember once or twice per class to tell a joke or say something to allow you to reset your mental apparatus. But the main problem with my jokes traditionally has been that I'm the only one who finds them funny. So I offer as a suggestion for this new class. Now this is my serious suggestion. Think about it. You guys do the jokes. Now, in the past, when I've asked the students to tell the jokes, no one has felt comfortable telling a joke, and you'll see why. Because I'll tell a joke and it'll bomb, and then it's who wants to put themselves in that position voluntarily? But nevertheless, there may be a brave soul in here. But even if there is not, that would be the dream situation. Would be someone actually comes up and tells a joke. That would be okay. I just want to emphasize to make eye contact with everyone in the room. That would be my dream. Okay. But if you're not comfortable doing that, if you have a joke that you can submit, you can even submit it anonymously to me somehow. I'm not sure exactly how you would do that. But alternatively, you could submit it to me. You could email it to me, let's say, and then I could tell it without attributing it to you, but just mentioning that it came from someone in the class. I guarantee the joke is going to go better if it comes from someone in the class instead of me. I'm just sure of it. There's going to be something, there's going to be a kind of natural goodwill there. And anyway, so that's okay. Those are all the initial announcements. So now I just wanted to say a couple words about why cosmology, I guess. You know, what's the point? And then try to give a rough outline of what the course will cover. So traditionally, just to be brief here, traditionally the reason people have been interested in cosmology is just that, you know, most people are just naturally interested in what the universe as a whole is like and you know, how it got started, how it evolves. And so the fact that within the past couple of decades, within the past century, but then much more rapidly within the past couple of decades, there's been real dramatic progress on that issue. Is interesting in and of itself. You know, then a more modern reason is just that for the past several decades, we have not gotten any real hints about physics beyond the Standard Model from laboratory experiments or tests in the solar system. They all seem to agree with the standard model that we'll discuss later in this lecture of gravity and of particle physics. And I know you guys have already had courses, and I mean you've already met the standard model and general relativity. So cosmology, all of our hints for beyond the standard model physics, basically at the moment, come from cosmology. Unfortunately, with the LHC not discovering anything, it seems like that may be true for some time into the future as well. So there's lots of hints. There's basically all of the big open questions in fundamental physics, where we actually have, you know, observations that are. It's not that they're sort of theoretical conundra that we're pondering, but actual unexplained observations out there. You know, those are all in cosmology. And so, and if you come up with a new model for something about physics, something about beyond the standard model physics, it's likely that the easiest and most immediate test for that will be in cosmology. Either it will help explain some of the current conundra in cosmology, or it will be blatantly in conflict with cosmological observations, even if you think it agrees with laboratory experiments. So that's why cosmology. Let me just briefly sketch the outline for the course. Okay, so today I'm going to sort of review the standard model of both gravity, by which I mean Einstein's general relativity, and particle physics. I know that a lot of you have already taken a standard model review course and have already taken Ruth's gravitational physics course. So I didn't, I don't want to bore the people who already know a lot about this, but I also want to do something to set the stage for everyone and especially for the people who have, may have less background in one of those two topics. In the past, what I've done is I've done a relatively long review of GR in this first lecture, and in practice, that a lot of people are bored by that. The new proposed thing this year is that if you look at lecture one, the notes on the wiki, they're a sort of condensed 5-page concise summary of, let's say, the core of general relativity. So if you're feeling like you need to brush up on general relativity, I recommend you read those notes. They should be pretty clear and pedagogical. In this lecture, I will go a little bit faster, and if you want, maybe not. I'll be a little bit faster, and then I'll also be wanting to get at the end of the lecture to the standard model itself, standard model of particle physics, just with the goal of describing, before we move on to, as I was saying, trying to make sense of what our understanding of the universe on the large scales is, and its hints for physics beyond the standard model, let's just start by trying to say in a concise sort of lightning review, what is the standard model? What is the model that describes everything in lab experiments on Earth and in the solar system? Okay, tomorrow we will start cosmology in earnest. Tomorrow will be sort of meet the three most important types of metrics. So there are the maximally symmetric spacetimes, the FRW spacetimes, and the black hole spacetimes. So we want to sort of meet all those metrics. There's a lot of metrics here, but if you kind of present them in a unified way, there's really not very much to get to know here. You can kind of pull a lot of things together, and we want to sort of understand how these guys are related to one another, because these are sort of the three classes of metrics that really play an important very important role in physics in one way or another. The rest of the solutions of Einstein's equations, you know, are so far appear to be basically of academic interest. So then lectures three and four, okay, so in other words, Wednesday and Friday, the idea is to focus in on the FRW metrics, which are the metrics that we think describe, well, that do, to a first approximation, describe our actual universe, and get to understand their physics, how particle propagation in those spacetimes, the interaction between the matter and the geometry in those spacetimes, how they evolve. So let's say kinematics and dynamics here. And the goal would be by the end of the week to be able to sort of have enough background that we could summarize what the current kind of so-called standard model of cosmology is, the so-called lambda CDM model. So that you know quantitatively what that guy is. Thursday, you know there's no lecture on Thursday because there's PI day that day, although there will be a cosmology talk there, which you can think of as a Thursday lecture. So next week you can, you know, so next week what I want to cover basically is, so week two, basically our two most important bits of observational evidence for the Big Bang at early times and most important probes of the early universe, Big Bang nucleosynthesis and the cosmic microwave background. We want to get to know those two guys, and then we'll be ready to begin to talk about the non-standard stuff that appears in cosmology. So we'll talk about, you know, dark matter. Dark energy and matter, antimatter asymmetry. How is this in terms of size? Can you guys read what I'm writing on the board? No. So these are three current observational puzzles that don't have an explanation, and so we'd just like to get the sense of what is the evidence for these things. What is, you know, we want to try to summarize what is the evidence for them, and what do we think we know about these things? What remains puzzling about them, basically? And then week three. I want to do more early universe and quantum mechanical stuff. So that will include introducing you to inflation, which is sort of currently, well, according to the majority in cosmology, it's kind of a done deal that inflation is the correct theory of the initial perturbations in the early universe. So anyway, I don't really subscribe to that, but let's get to know this guy and understand what is meant by that and why people think that. And then related to that, we're going to want to introduce quantum field theory and curved space-time, which is an interesting subject in its own right, and we'll sort of want to try to understand the relationship between some famous quantum field theory and curved space-time effects. See how basically the Unruh effect, the fact that an accelerated observer effect, the fact that an accelerated observer accelerating through the vacuum sees himself in a thermal state, black hole thermodynamics, the black hole evaporation, and the primordial spectrum of perturbations produced in general, not just inflation, but in particular inflation, the primordial spectrum of cosmological perturbations. And we sort of want to understand what is the relationship between these guys. And then finally, hopefully, hopefully in the last lecture or two, I would like to talk about sort of a theory of initial conditions. So, most of what is discussed traditionally in cosmology, and this includes inflation, falls in the category of if the universe was in such and such a state at such and such a time initially, how does it evolve, and then what is it like at a later time? What is usually absent is it. Even in inflation, is a theory for why the initial state was what it was. So I just wanted to basically discuss that issue because, it looks like that could be a place where there's really very interesting and fundamental stuff to be done. And I would also like to mention that, there's really one, to my mind, really, great proposal that goes the most ambitious attempt in this direction was made in the early 80s by Hartle and Hawking. That's their proposal for the wave function of the universe. And it's a little bit hard to say, in a sense, how successful or unsuccessful this proposal has been compared to data. But anyway, it's really a beautiful idea, and it's really definitely like sets the current benchmark for if you're going to attempt this problem, how well should you try to do, before you think you've made progress. Okay, so that's the overview. So now let me go on with this lecture. So the idea is in 40 minutes, I want to give a kind of blitz review of the current standard model of gravity, so that's general relativity, and then the standard model of particle physics. In 40 minutes, this is going to be rather condensed. So I just want to sort of present the logic. If you want to go through the discussion of differential geometry and general relativity in more detail and brush up on that, again, I encourage you to look at the first set of lecture notes. The standard model stuff that I'll say, I didn't even include that in the lecture notes because I'm, well, anyway, if you, so I'll present the sort of, concisely stated logic of where the standard model of physics comes from as currently understood, or at least the standard understanding of it. And then there's a very valuable exercise, which is to go from that initial data and actually derive the expression for the actual Lagrangian for the standard model. That is an exercise that I highly recommend, but I won't have time to actually do that on the board here. And anyway, if you're interested in doing that, you can try it, or if you get stuck, you can talk to me, and I can. Give you tips about how to do it, but okay, let's plunge ahead. So, GR. Well, so GR rests upon differential geometry. So let's just very briefly review what differential geometry is all about. Okay, so differential geometry proceeds in three steps. You sort of conceptually speaking. Step one, you introduce a manifold. And tensors can live over that manifold at each point. Step two, you introduce a connection on the manifold. Um, And once you've introduced the connection, or in other words, you introduce the notion of a covariant derivative, once you've introduced these objects, all of a sudden there's all sorts of new questions you can ask and new calculations you can do, new geometry you can do regarding the tensors that live over your manifold. And then step three, you introduce a metric onto the manifold. Okay, so you introduce this guy, the metric G mu nu, and again, once you've introduced him, again, there's all sorts of new things you can calculate, quantities you can talk about, new notions that enter geometry. So let's briefly talk about this guy. So again, a manifold, by an n-dimensional manifold, I just mean, you know, a blob such that if I zoom in close enough near any point on that blob, it looks like a little patch of n-dimensional Euclidean space. And then above each point, we have tensors living, and so we describe this. We can lay down n-dimensional coordinates to describe what point on the manifold we're talking about. So, for example, we might lay down a coordinate system that locally looks like this. This might be the x-coordinates, and above this point there might be this tensor T with T alpha beta with a bunch of components in the x-coordinate system. And then what makes it a tensor is that if I now choose a different set of coordinates, let's call them the x prime coordinates, well, in those new coordinates, I will describe the same tensor T as having different values for its coordinates. So it'll have new values, T prime alpha beta. And the fact that it's a tensor means that the values in the new coordinate system are related to the values in the old coordinate system by a tensor transformation law, which just means that for every index, I multiply it by an appropriate factor to correct for the coordinate transformation. So, for example, if I have an up index, every time I have an up index, I have a factor that looks like dx prime gamma over dx prime alpha over dx gamma. Every time I have a down index, I have a factor that looks like the prime coordinate is on the bottom and the unprime coordinate is on the top, times the tensor in the old coordinates. Okay, and so that's basically life on the manifold before we have a connection or a metric. Not too interesting. So now, step two, we introduce a connection. So, you know, what's the idea here? The idea is that, okay, so suppose I give you an object, T alpha beta, and I tell you it's a tensor. You're psyched about that because tensors transform so simply. You're like, yes, it's going to be easy for me to write down coordinate independent quantities now. I'll be able to write down anything I want. And so you say, you know, I could even take derivatives of it, but then you actually check. You check what is the relationship between, if you take the, are you guys familiar with this notation, d mu, this Ruth's notation, d mu is equal to, partial with a mu subscript is shorthand for the partial derivative d dx mu. So yeah, you actually check how it transforms under coordinate transformation. And alas, it does not transform like a tensor. If you just plug in the tensor transformation law for this guy and the chain rule for how this guy transforms and check, you know, is this guy related to this guy by a couple of appropriate, by three appropriate factors like this for each of the indices, the answer is no. So you say, no problem, I can fix that. You define a new type of derivative called the covariant derivative. So you replace partial mu by del mu. And you define the action of this guy to be a sort of corrected form. So for every up index, you add a connection term. And for every down index, you add some sort of, I mean, you subtract some term like that. Okay, so you define this covariant derivative, and then you just define the transformation law of these gammas under a coordinate transformation. You define it to be such that this object does transform like a tensor. Okay, and again, that particular transformation law that you have to invoke, is reviewed in the lecture notes. Okay, great. So now suddenly we have we can take derivatives on our manifold. We can take derivatives of tensors and get new tensors. Now, you know, we'd like to describe what is this new structure we've put on the manifold. This connection. You might say, oh well, it's just that connection. And again, we have the complaint about this guy that, well, okay, this is indeed the connection, but now it's not a tensor. It doesn't transform like a tensor. We'd like somehow to find an object that describes what this tensor, what new structure this tensor has provided on the manifold, what new structure this connection has provided on the manifold, but describes it via a tensor. So this guy is not a tensor. What can we do to get a tensor from him? And the answer discovered, well, and the answer is that if we take the commutator of two covariant derivatives acting on a tensor. So for example, let's take the commutator of two covariant derivatives acting on a vector. Okay, then the result is just a tensor times that vector. This is the so-called Ricci identity. Okay, so this equation you can take to define this tensor, and if you just plug in this expression for the covariant derivative in terms of the gammas, if you in terms of the partial derivative and the gammas, you plug in that expression and expand it out, you'll get this sort of famous formula for the Riemann tensor, where there's two terms that are derivative of gamma minus some other derivative of gamma, and then plus gamma gamma, and then minus gamma gamma. Again, if you want to go through the explicit calculation and see the explicit formula, it's in the notes. Okay, great. So now we've gotten the curvature tensor. So at this stage, the curvature tensor has entered the story. And then we also have the notion of parallel transporting. Now that we have a covariant derivative, we can talk about parallel transporting tensors. So we used to just be talking about tensors over an individual point, but now we can think about the relationship between the tensors over two different points given a path connecting them. So if you have a tensor living over each point here, we say that tensor is parallel transported along the curve between these two points A and B. We can now say that it's parallel transported if it's covariant derivative, if it's directional derivative along that, I'll say the tensor T beta gamma is parallel transported along this curve if its directional derivative along that curve vanishes. So here U is the tangent vector to the curve. And in particular, if you have a, you, now that we've introduced the connection, we have a notion of what a geodesic is, because there's a special sort of curve here. So again, suppose we have some curve x alpha of tau, which goes from point A to point B, and its tangent vector is U alpha. Okay, in other words, just dx alpha d tau. Then for a special class of curves, that the tangent vector will be parallel transported by the curve itself. Okay, so in other words, I've just taken the parallel transport equation, but instead of a general t, I've plugged in nothing else than the tangent vector to the curve itself. So if the tangent vector is parallel transported along, if you have a curve that parallel transports its own tangent vector, that's a geodesic. Okay, so that's so far. Now we've gotten to this. We've gone through this stage. So once we introduced a connection or a covariant derivative on the manifold, life got a bit more interesting. There was more stuff we could do, but it still doesn't yet smell quite like the universe we live in. So the final stage is to introduce a metric on the manifold. So for two infinitesimally nearby points with coordinates, let's say x mu, and this guy has x mu plus dx mu, the metric lets me determine the distance between those two points. The invariant distance squared between those two points is just g mu nu, the metric evaluated at the point x of interest, contracted with the coordinate, the little infinitesimal coordinate distance between those two points. Okay, so we have this new tensor that gives us. So now, in addition to talking about parallel transport along curves, we can talk about the length of the curves. It's just we just integrate up ds all along the curve to compute the length of it. We get a new notion of what a geodesic is. Now a geodesic, there's a new, well, oh, sorry, I should say first. So we have introduced, previously we had introduced a connection, gamma alpha beta, and we just chose whatever connection we wanted. Now we have introduced a metric g mu nu, and we can just choose whatever metric we want. But now that we've introduced a metric, not all connections are equally nice. There is a one that is naturally most suited to this metric, which is called the Levi-Civita connection. And it is, in particular, it is the connection that, once I've specified the metric, it's the unique connection that satisfies, first of all, it's torsion-free, so in other words, it's symmetric in its bottom two indices. And on the other hand, it satisfies the fact, it gives rise to a covariant derivative that annihilates G. Okay, so this is called metric compatibility. So the covariant derivative of the metric is zero. Those two conditions determine the Levi-Civita connection in terms of the metric, and it's given by this formula you may be familiar with, probably are familiar with. Okay, so again, for the derivation of that, see the notes. So finally, now that we have a metric, now that we have a manifold endowed with a metric, and from now on we will assume that the connection is this Levi-Civita connection determined by the metric, then it turns out there's a new equivalent way to describe what a geodesic is. We previously said a geodesic was a curve that parallel transported its own tangent vector, and for that we didn't need a metric to define such curves. But now that we have a metric, we can define a tangent vector as, I mean, we can define a geodesic as a curve that is an extremum of length. So it's a curve through the manifold such that any infinitesimal perturbation in the curve does not perturb its length to first order. Okay, any small perturbation you only see the change in length of the curve to second order. That turns out to be equivalent to what we said before. But for practical purposes, it's nice because it gives a much easier way to actually calculate the geodesics, actually find the equations that they satisfy. Because if you have some metric, g mu nu of x times dx mu dx nu, now let's just replace that by a Lagrangian. Of the same form, but I'll just replace each of these dx mu's and dx nu's by x dots, by x dot mu and x dot nu, where x dot mu is dx mu d tau. Okay, now just think of this guy as a Lagrangian. In other words, a Lagrangian usually depends on some coordinates q and their time derivatives q dot. And then you calculate the Euler-Lagrange equations. The equations, the dynamical equations governing q and q dot are given by dl dq is equal to partial with respect to q dot dot. Right? In other words, dl dq dot, and then you take that quantity, you take another tau derivative of it. Those are the Euler-Lagrange equations. Well, if x and x dot are our q and q dot, the geodesic equation is just equivalent to the Euler-Lagrange equation that you would calculate from this guy. And as we'll see in a couple of days, you know, this gives a much easier way, for example, to determine the geodesic equations in FRW spacetime than using, and you know, if you explicitly use this equation, for which you would first have to calculate all the Christoffel symbols. Okay, so let's see. I think we're pretty much done with differential geometry. Yeah?
Are curves usually
like
saddle points or minima or maxima?
Well, so if it's a Riemannian manifold, they are minima. So if it's by Riemannian manifold, I mean a manifold where all directions of the metric, if you diagonalize the metric is a symmetric matrix. So you can always diagonalize it and it'll have real eigenvalues. If all of those eigenvalues are positive, then the geodesics are minima of the length. But in the case where the signature is mixed, where there are some time-like directions and some space-like directions, then that's no longer true. Okay, yeah, so that's all of differential geometry. Good time to stop for my first joke. You know, this actually isn't even a joke. I was just thinking about this last night. And so when I first went to, when I first met my wife, so my wife is Russian, and I first met her, you know, we used to go sometimes to visit her grandmother who lived in this apartment with all these other Russian grandmothers who had immigrated to the United States. And so she used to say, at that time I didn't speak Russian, so she used to say these things, and then my wife would translate them to me. And okay, anyway, these are just a couple. Some of them really stick with me. So like, she, one of the, maybe like the first time I went to visit her, when she wanted to say something, she would always begin by saying, ah, and then she would say something, 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 which I didn't understand. And my wife would say, she wants to tell you this. And so she said, ah, something, something, something. My wife pointed, there was a cockroach on her kitchen floor, happened to be running across her kitchen floor. She said, my grandmother says that's her neighbor's cockroach. Anyway, so. I have to dull these things out in small, small quantities, but I'll have to see. We'll have to at least get through general relativity before you get another one. Okay, 20 minutes left. General relativity. So really all I want to do here is go through a derivation for the Lagrangian, or the action, for general relativity, by comparing the structure of general relativity with gauge theory, with Yang-Mills theory. So the two structures are quite parallel, but then there's a point at which they diverge, and it's just interesting to see how that leads to the structure of the Lagrangian for general relativity on the one hand being different from the structure of the Lagrangian for gauge theory on the other hand. So what we just said was that we had a tensor in differential geometry, but the derivative of it, the partial derivative of it, was not a tensor itself. So we introduce a new type of derivative, covariant derivative, by taking the partial derivative and adding to it a connection. Beginning to fall apart. So similarly, in gauge theory, let's say we have an n tuplet of fields that transform, you know, under the gauge group SUN. So just like this guy, just like V alpha would transform under a gauge transformation of general relativity, by which I just mean a coordinate transformation. You transform like dx alpha, dx prime beta, what am I doing? Sorry. I'm thinking ahead and so not paying attention while I write here. Apologies. So this guy transforms like v prime alpha is equal to dx prime alpha dx beta v beta, so it transforms with some space-time dependent matrix here. So in gauge theory, we similarly have some set of, let's say, n scalar fields or n fermionic fields, which transform under a gauge transformation to a new set of components. Again, space-time dependent. And so just like this space-time dependent matrix led us to introduce a connection here that transformed appropriately. Similarly, when we take the partial derivative of this guy, if we took just an ordinary partial derivative, again, we would find that partial derivative no longer transformed nicely with respect to the gauge transformation. So instead, we introduce the gauge covariant derivative, d mu. Okay, and so here you can explicitly see these two formulae are closely parallel to one another, and you can see in the gauge case, it's explicit that this matrix A really has two different types of indices. This index is a space-time index. It points in the direction that the derivative is being taken. These two indices, but with respect to these two indices, if you ignore the space-time index, the other two indices are both indices in the gauge bundle. They tell you how this object transforms under a gauge transformation, how these n components rotate into one another. And so really similarly, secretly over here, we have an index that points in the direction of the derivative, and then two indices that tell you how a tensor rotates in the tangent bundle. But again, you can think of it as there's a direction that points along the direction of the derivative, an index that corresponds to the direction of the derivative, and another two indices that together form a matrix that sort of performs a little correction to what the partial derivative would do. Okay, and so again, both these guys have to transform in a certain way to make these things transform like tensors, but the problem is that the resulting transformation law makes these things, the two connections, the connection on the tangent bundle or the connection on the gauge bundle, these guys no longer transform like tensors. So we do what we did before. We to construct a tensor out of them, we take the commutator of two covariant derivatives. And we get a thing that does transform like a tensor, and this thing is the so-called curvature of this connection. Okay, so in this case, this is the so-called Riemann curvature tensor. But we do exactly the analogous thing over here. We take the commutator of two covariant derivatives. And with the exact same formula up to a couple of extra minus signs. I guess I also, conventionally, there's also a minus sign over here. I mean, factor of I mean. Apart from a couple of factors of I that you usually include on the gauge theory side, but not on the general relativity side, you take an identical formula. And this formula is formally identical to this, but over here, where we define the Riemann curvature, here we're defining the curvature of the gauge connection, which you normally you just suppress these indices, write this guy like this, and you just call this the field strength. In the electromagnetic case, the index only runs over one component, so you don't even need these indices. So you just get F mu nu. But in the non-abelian case, in the Yang-Mills case, this is your Yang-Mills field strength. It has two space-time indices, but then two other indices which make it a matrix in the tangent bundle. Okay, so great. So we have this tensor over here. You know, we have a tensor, and now we would just like to build an action from the tensors that we've defined. You know, an action is supposed to be a scalar. It's not supposed to transform. It's supposed to not transform under either coordinate transformations or gauge transformations. So we have to somehow figure out how to combine up all these indices so that there's no hanging indices left over. Well, in this case, the answer is that there's a simple way we can do it. Well, the simplest thing we can write down, first of all, the simplest term we could write down in the action that doesn't transform under coordinate transformations is just a constant. So let's just write down a constant, and in fact, we'll call that minus 2 times a constant, just for later convenience. But then the next simplest thing we can do is take just one copy of the Riemann tensor, and we first contract this index and this index to get the Ricci tensor, and then we contract the remaining two indices with the metric to get the Ricci scalar. Okay, so that's the simplest. Those are the simplest two scalars we can write down, and so if we just put a 1/16, if we just divide this thing by 16 pi times Newton's constant, that's the action for general relativity. So, you know, note that if we try to play the same game here, we will be stymied, because over here our first step was to contract this index with that index. But over here you can see that it's a bit of a coincidence in general relativity that those two indices are of the same type. These last two indices are really space-time indices. In both cases, these two indices
our indices in whatever bundle this curvature operates on. And so in this case, these are indices in the gauge bundle. You simply, there's no sensible way to contract these two. So you can't form a scalar. There's no way you will succeed in forming a scalar from just a single copy of F. So you have to go on to the next simplest thing, which is to take two copies of F. And first, you can get rid of their spacetime indices by contracting them up. So and then you can get rid of the matrix indices by just multiplying the matrices and then taking the trace, which means contracting A with C. Okay, so in other words, there are more, as you would more normally write this, this is just trace of F mu nu. So that now that guy, if you just multiply that by minus a quarter, canonically normalize it, that is the Yang-Mills action. Okay? So the thing I want to emphasize here is just that the structure is very closely parallel, introducing covariant derivatives, introducing curvatures. But then the last step when we want to form the simplest scalar that we can out of those guys, the one with the fewest numbers of derivatives, the stories diverge and we get away with a linear action in general relativity. And we have to use a quadratic one in Yang-Mills theory. Okay, so that is all as I said, it's going to be lightning. So that was the main thing I was going to say about general relativity. In principle, once you're here, you're home free. You just add whatever matter Lagrangian you want to the Lagrangian for general relativity, and then once you have the Lagrangian, you calculate the Euler-Lagrange equations, or you calculate scattering amplitudes, or you do whatever you normally do with a Lagrangian. But the point is, in principle, you can do it once you know the Lagrangian, you know everything about the theory. Yeah.
What's the significance of taking the simplest? Because we had a work on this last time. If you take the Riemann tensor with Riemann tensor, you get to estimate that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So in both cases, the usual answer is that, and the answer that I'm going to give is that from an effective field theory standpoint, if you take any renormalizable theory and then integrate out scales and look at it on some macroscopic scale, you get some effective Lagrangian that describes physics on that relatively long wavelength, the leading most important terms in that effective Lagrangian are expected to be the ones that are, are the ones that have the coupling constants of highest positive dimension. In particular, the so-called relevant operators at long wavelengths are the ones that have coupling constants of non-negative dimension. So what I've written down here are this guy would correspond to a term with mass dimension to the fourth out front. This term has mass dimension squared. Indeed, there's a next term which would involve two powers of R. Actually, there's a couple terms you can write down that are built from two powers of the Riemann tensor. Those have a dimensionless coupling constant. Now it turns out that those may be present. Those probably are present. The experimental constraints on this coupling constant, on these coupling constants, on those terms are so weak that in practice you just ignore them in thinking about tests in the solar system, for example. But in principle, there's all these other terms, but beyond these three quadratic and curvature terms you can write down, the other terms all have negative mass dimension coupling constants, so are expected to be very suppressed at low energies. They're expected, those terms are expected to be suppressed by something like 1 over the Planck scale to some power. Similarly, in the standard model, when you write down the standard model, you only write down the terms that have non-negative, that have coupling constants with non-negative mass dimension. Presumably, it is believed for the same reason that even if there's some more bigger theory at high energies, and the standard model just represents the light degrees of freedom that you see at longer wavelengths, that the relevant terms at low energies will only be those ones with zero or positive mass dimension for their coupling constant. Okay. Shall I attempt a 3-minute standard model blitz, or is that crazy? Or both? It's also both is the answer, possible answer. Okay. So the key thing about the standard model is that, the only thing that I'll say is this. So the algorithm for choosing, for sort of defining the standard model as it is normally understood, is that you start by choosing the symmetry group. So you decide that you want a theory that is Lorentz invariant, Poincaré invariant, Lorentz invariant and space-time translation invariant, and has in addition, some gauge symmetries. So you choose the gauge group. So in the standard model, you choose it to be SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. Okay, and I'm going to make those the top row in a table. So now next, you're not done defining the theory yet. Turns out once you've chosen the gauge group, which gauge bosons you're going to have in your theory is fixed. You just have one gauge boson for every generator of this group. So for U1, there's only one generator. You have one gauge boson for that. For SU2, that's a group with three generators. So you have three SU2 gauge bosons. For SU3, that has eight generators. So there are eight gluons. And they have to transform. Each of them has to transform in the so-called adjoint representation with respect to each of those groups. So structure of the gauge bosons is basically fixed, but you still have more choosing to do. You have to choose what fermions and what scalar fields you want to have in your model, and you have to choose what representations they should lie in with respect to these three groups. How should they transform under the gauge transformation? So that's what this table summarizes. So here are the fermions we're going to put in. We're going to put in a left-handed quark doublet. By a doublet, I mean that we can think of it as being a combination of two quarks, a left-handed up quark and a left-handed down quark. Then we'll have a right-handed up quark and a right-handed down quark. And then we'll do the analogous thing for the leptons. So that's the quarks. For the leptons, we have a left-handed lepton doublet, which again, I call it a doublet because it splits into a left-handed neutrino and a left-handed electron. And then we have the right-handed, corresponding right-handed guys each get their own row. Okay, so now I'm just going to fill in what representation, what representation each of these fermions lies in. So the three quarks, the thing that makes them quarks, is that they transform non-trivially as a three-dimensional representation of SU3. So in other words, you can think of these guys as tensors, just like the tensors we've been dealing with in GR, but just with different sorts of indices. So each of these guys is a fermion. So for one thing, it has a fermionic index. It's a four-component complex. It's a complex four-component vector that transforms like a spinner, like you learned a spinner transformed in quantum field theory class under Lorentz transformation. So that's one of its indices. But in addition, this is saying it has another, these three guys have another index, which runs from 1 to 3, and which transforms under the three-dimensional representation of SU3. Everybody else doesn't transform. They all lie in the so-called singlet representation, which really just means they're trivial. They don't carry an SU3 index. Then the next column, well, the rule, for some reason we don't know in the standard model, is that the left-handed fermions, Q left and L left, transform in the two-dimensional representation of SU2. So that's what this two-component vector is. I've grouped them into their two-dimensional vector under which they transform under an SU2 transformation. And then the rest of them are all singlets. They don't carry it. All the right-handed fermions are all singlets. They don't carry an SU2 index. And then finally, there's their so-called hypercharge, which for the right-handed guys is just equal to their electric charge. And then the left-handed guy, its hypercharge, you know, is assigned to be the average of those two values. So this one is minus 1/2, and this one is plus 1/6. And then we've left off one other line in the table, which is the scalar. We're going to only put one scalar field in the model, the Higgs boson, and we have to assign it some charges. So we say it doesn't have a SU3 index, doesn't feel color. It will transform like a doublet under SU2, and it has some hypercharge, which happens to be 1/2. Okay, so that's kind of the status of the standard model at the moment. You have to give this kind of arbitrary, weird-looking table of numbers to specify the charges and transformation laws of all the different fields. So that kind of looks gross. That's the bad news. The good news is, once I've written that table on the board, you're done. You're now just instructed to, oh, there's one more thing I forgot to tell you, sorry. One more thing, another unexplained fact about the standard model is that I've written down just the up quark, down quark, neutrino electron, but each of these fermions comes in three copies that have exactly the same charges and transformation laws. Okay, so each of these really has an extra index, which runs from 1 to 3, called the family index. No, we don't know why. So far, there has been nothing observed to suggest that this index transforms with respect to any symmetry or couples to anything. It's just there for some reason. For some reason, the fermions come in three copies. Okay, now that I've given you that table, you will quickly recover from your initial disgust and be very impressed that now, once I've given you that table, you can just go, you have all the information you need. You just go off and write down the most general renormalizable Lagrangian that you can write down. In other words, you just write down every combination of these terms that you can think of such that the gauge bosons each have mass dimension 1. The fermions each have mass dimension 3/2. The scalar field has mass dimension 1. So now you're instructed to go off and write down every term you can think of that is renormalizable, meaning that, which in practice means that when you add up the mass dimensions of all the fields in that term, it's less than or equal to 4. Because that turns out to be the condition, as I was saying before, that turns out to be the condition in four dimensions for its coupling constant to either be dimensionless or have positive mass. So we want to have a renormalizable theory. We're not going to take any terms that have a coupling constant with a negative mass dimension. So you just want it to be renormalizable, and then besides that, you want it to be invariant under Lorentz symmetry and under all of these gauge symmetries. So in other words, I haven't shown all of the indices explicitly here, but if you imagine writing down on each of these fields an extra index for each non-trivial transformation that it has, and also keeping in mind that it transforms as if it with a certain U1 charge. Just try to write down every term you can that has no free hanging indices and transforms as a whole like it has charge zero under U1. And that's the standard model Lagrangian. That Lagrangian appears to perfectly fit all of the experiments that we can do on the Earth. So I'll stop there because I'm already 5 minutes over. Sorry about that. But so I was just going to say that was too fast to actually have you be in a position to do it on your own, I think. But I'll have to decide whether to just, I think because this is supposed to be a cosmology course, I may leave that topic behind. What do you guys think? There's some incredibly valuable exercise to be done, which is to, for some reason, no one ever had me do this in a class, and I am sworn to not repeat the same mistake. Although I'm not actually going to have you do it, but I will at least suggest that it's a great idea to do it. To go from this table to try to write down the full Lagrangian for the standard model. It's there's nothing like it in terms of really really understanding the structure of the theory. But my suggestion is that even though I'm trying to get you guys all pumped up about that exercise, that I in practice will actually drop it now and go on to cosmology like I was planning in the next lecture. Does that sound? You in agreement with that? Okay, yeah. So, okay, sounds good. Anyway, thanks. Sorry, I will not run over in the future.